Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. This summer, we continue to feature and highlight amazing guests. Today, I'm very honored to have with us Karen Lee, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Pioneer Human Services, which is one of the nation's largest nonprofit social enterprise organizations in the United States. Pioneer provides career paths and living wage jobs for a population many disregard. Karen, thank you so much for being here with us on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Stephen.
It's awesome. I mean, first and foremost, I just continue to love this opportunity that we have with the podcast to keep scaling what we're doing and be able to highlight organizations, yours included. Before we go too much further, can you share just with the audience all about Pioneer Human Services, what you do, what your mission is, and why you're passionate about it?
Yes. Our mission is to help people that are impacted by mass incarceration and to help them live a healthy and productive life. And it's really as simple as that. Unfortunately, the causes of why people are incarcerated are complex, and they're also rooted in social inequity and injustice. And so we have to acknowledge and kind of deal with those issues along the way. And then they're exacerbated by, poverty and drug addiction and discrimination. So all of those, I would say, social ills has resulted in a part of the population that is disenfranchised. And quite frankly, they feel like they have never been a part of society, and they haven't really been a part of what I call the legal American dream. And so what we want to do at Pioneer is to change that trajectory for people. So the way that we offer services, first of all, we're a social enterprise like your company. And so we have services in a traditional nonprofit sense, social services that address why people are in the situation that they're in. And then we have businesses, which we call our enterprises, that offer living wage employment and career opportunities, and then also some profits that they throw off. We use that to support the social services work, although we have to also supplement that with fundraising and philanthropy. So it's a full service organization because the people that we serve have a complete set of needs that if you only address one aspect of their individual needs, you're not going to really make change. So what we have found is that if all of a person's needs are met, then they can live a healthy and productive life, no matter what happened in their background, no matter what they've done in the past, no matter what we call in our field their criminogenic risk profile, which is someone's likelihood to commit an offense. We can reduce that all the way to, I would say, less than 4%. If we can really address all the needs the individual has, and then we allow them to have an income. So the businesses that we have at Pioneer Human Services, our main business is aerospace manufacturing. So if you've ever flown in a 737 aircraft or a 757, Pioneer makes a number of the parts that you see in the inside of the plane. And the biggest one that we talk about is an assembly that's actually the exit row door. So if you're sitting in an exit row, sometimes it's like seat 15F, A, B, C, D, E, F.
I always try to get the exit row.
Yeah, because you get extra leg room, Right. Yeah, and then if you're in the second one, you can lean back too.
I guess this makes sense too. I'm interjecting, but you're up in the Seattle, Washington area.
Yeah.
So Boeing and whatnot are there, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And we do make this part for Boeing, but we have other customers. But that's called an escape hatch assembly. And we make those in one of our plants here in Seattle. And we also make a number of other parts, but I like to talk about that one because people can recognize it and they can see it, So whenever you see an exit row door, you think about Pioneer. So yeah, but the staff that make that are skilled water jet operators, press brake operators. You know, we also have a machine shop. That's another type of plant, but they are skilled, I would say, trades workers. And they, those positions really can offer a high quality of life to people. And they're in demand in the workplace. We have to work hard to keep our talent, but we have that building, that business, and then it all, and it throws off some profit that we can use to our, for our social mission. And then we have some smaller businesses, construction and food service, but the big one is actually aerospace manufacturing. And we have three factories here in the Seattle area.
Can you take me back to when was Pioneer Human Services started? Approximately what year?
Yes, 1963. And it was started by our founder was a lawyer who was an alcoholic. And at one point he started drinking up his client funds. That's not a good thing for lawyers to do. He was disbarred, sent to prison. It's a felony offense here in our state. And when he was in prison, he really worked hard to become sober. And he participated in AA. That's what they did back in the 60s. And then there were volunteers from Seattle that would drive to Walla Walla, where the penitentiary was. It's about a 4.5 hour drive from Seattle. And they would lead AA group once a week. And Jack Dalton participated in AA. When he finished his sentence, he came back to Pioneer. And the other members of his AA group, as they were releasing, they didn't come from middle class. I mean, Jack Dalton came from upper class in Seattle. He ran for Senate. So he was a really, he was the type of guy that could really convince you to do anything. And he got people to invest in a house, and that was Pioneer Fellowship House. And then his AA buddies moved in, and they had to pay rent. So, so Jack knew some folks at Boeing and asked for a contract to do one thing. And then that company was actually folded into Pioneer. So from the very beginning, Pioneer has been about, you know, substance use disorder and treatment, housing, and employment. And you offer those three things and people can feel like they're a part of society and move on with their lives. So today, you know, treatment is much more sophisticated than it was back then, right? We have, you know, it's, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction is considered a disease, which is important. It follows a disease path, and we look at it more and more as an illness. And so the healthcare system is how we attack and address substance use disorder. But there is still discrimination today against people that are formerly incarcerated. When it comes to housing, they're 10 times more likely to be homeless than anyone else. And there is still discrimination in the workforce. And so in the labor market. And you see that with when you apply for jobs, it'll say, have you ever had a felony conviction in the past 7 years? Well, employers use that as a way to screen people out. And they overuse that tool. So so the those basic blocks that were still that were here in 1963 are still here in 2021. And then it's overlaid with using incarceration as a substitute for some of the Jim Crow activities that we saw in the 60s. So the need is still there, although it's a little bit different. So in Pioneer, today we have, we're in 40 locations you know, around 80 million in revenue. But we have also all these services and we have apartment buildings that go along with the work that we do. So our services are what we call jail diversion. So instead of sending someone to jail for a very low level misdemeanor related to drug use or public intoxication, we have what's called diversion centers. And we have a number of those, where we really work with folks to get them to treatment. We have a number of substance use disorder treatment and mental health facilities around the state of Washington, which are residential up to 60 day stays. We have apartment buildings that people can live after treatment. And then we have job training and case management services so that people can enter the labor market. And then finally, we have employment opportunities. So if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, the very bottom is safety and stability. And then the very top is self-actualization. Pioneer offers services at every one of those need levels so that people, whatever they need from an individual basis, they can get what they need from Pioneer so that they can, you know, move forward with their life journey.
What would be one of the services on the self-actualization side?
That is employment, as I think about it. That's employment, voting, buying your first home, mm-hmm. those types of things, right? The shelter side, the lowest level is diversion from jail. So you are homeless, you have no place to stay, and you're in the throes of a deep addiction, and you are, I would say, doing activities that people would consider to be a public nuisance, right? You're breaking into cars because you see a $20 bill and you need to get your next high. So those are called, and we just call that jail diversion. Mm-hmm. But as you could see, you move up as you recover and you begin to get well, then life kind of changes for you. And you have a number of barriers that you have to go through, you have to deal with so that you can kind of put your past behind you. 80% of all arrests have the arrestees have some type of drugs in their system. And if you think of George Floyd, that's clear, right? You know, he was claustrophobic and he also had drugs in his system. And here he is arrested for a low level crime. And we know what happens after that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what we're here to stop.
Understood. How does, I want to make sure I pronounce it accurately, but I've been hearing a lot more so lately about recidivism, mm-hmm. And that there's, that whether it's on the, I guess it could be the federal or the state or the local level, them recognize, you know, again, the governmental entities are recognizing that if they can focus on reducing the amount of people that get incarcerated, that it actually like generates more revenue for them. It's basically just costing the states a lot. I'm curious, like your comments on that. And if you all have been able to tie in because I can come back to it to specifically ask that question. But one of the things, if I sort of do a timeout, like what I'm hearing from you and which I think is really phenomenal is how your organization is able to put this full wrapper and recognize the 360 degree view of needing to basically provide all these different sorts of programs and services to actually try to help people. And a lot of organizations that we work with included are doing great work, but they're only focused on a very acute, like singular issue. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times because like this area is so significant of what you're trying to do, if you're not taking a holistic approach, you're probably not going to solve the problem. My other comment to you, which I think is pretty sort of amazing too, is how you have blended really from the get-go when you explained the founding story, the business model for the organization, because so many nonprofits rely on just a single stream of income. Maybe it's just donors from individuals, or maybe they're super just grant heavy. But the fact that you've been able to create these earned revenue streams, a la, you know, contracts and partnerships with Boeing or other entities, that is really cool and forward thinking. So I know I started with the recidivism. We can get back to that, but I'm just curious, you know, I know you've been at the organization now since 2010. I imagine, you know, you have other experience, whether friends or on the board or you see other organizations, you know, what do you think it is about Pioneer Human Services that has made it unique to be able to, mm-hmm. you know, stay afloat and do so much for so long, which I could go on and on about this point, but, you know, there's a huge, we don't talk about it enough in this industry, but there's a huge failure rate in startups or new business creation. There's a huge failure rate in nonprofits. So anyway, I think it's remarkable that you've been at it for this long. So I'm sure the audience would love to hear just your thoughts on why it's been successful for so long.
I think that it's had, for the most part, Pioneer's had really good leadership, and that's important. You know, the social enterprise model is not a golden ticket. I tell people that all the time. People ask me, oh my gosh, you must have it made because you're a social enterprise. You know, it's difficult. And social enterprises go out of business like everybody else. And I think in some ways it's easier for us because we kind of get our missions confused. We might be too mission heavy and not pay attention enough to the business, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you look up and your products aren't competitive. Or you focus only on the business and then your mission part is kind of fake or phony and it's just a tax write-off. So I think that you have those two extremes that you have to really work hard to stay in the middle. So I would say that it's been good leadership, but I've also would say in the 60s, I don't think business was as competitive as it is today. So when Pioneer was born, it was an era when there wasn't as much competition from Mexico or another country. So I think that we kind of had just like most companies, you know, that were born during that time, there wasn't global competition. So if you could do good work, then your company and what you did was in demand. I think that you could be successful. Mm-hmm. And luckily for us, we're not supplying a company like Kodak, right, where people don't use cameras. We supply companies that provide us with air transportation, and that end product is very much in demand. And so that's been a part of our key to success as well.
Because I'm just curious to ask, what was COVID like for you then? I mean, I imagine that there was still cargo and stuff, but there can be, I think it's a good point that you bring up. I mean, like, I'm very happy for you and I would want you and, you know, all organizations ideally pick business models that are recession proof or natural disaster proof or COVID proof, et cetera. But yeah, can you comment on the last year and if there were any takeaways for you as a leader and how you all have pivoted or adapted?
Well, I would say we've had to use our balance sheet. So yes. COVID has been particularly difficult because we're an aerospace company and aerospace was hit hard. And we didn't necessarily at Pioneer have an answer. So we don't have two businesses that are the same size, right? We have aerospace and it's four times the size of our next largest business. So that meant that even if that other business was doing well, you know, if aerospace has not done well, and it was already kind of in the doldrums because the 737 MAX had challenges. So our largest aerospace customer, was not making as many planes. So that means we don't make as many escape hatch assemblies. And then our other, you know, customers weren't, our other aerospace customers, you know, so cargo planes are still kind of, they're still on the same frame. So if your cargo plane's a 737 MAX, if the 737 MAX is grounded for passenger or cargo, it doesn't really matter. So when we make parts, it can go on a cargo plane or a passenger aircraft. We don't even often know. But I would say, I lost my train of thought a bit, but you know, we didn't have a balance. And that's something that the board and I talked about was, do we need to have two equal size enterprises because aerospace is boom or bust? Or should we just keep a lot of money on our balance sheet and be prepared for a bust? So my board and I have had those discussions, and all business is risky. And then it's difficult for a company to be really super good at a lot of different things. So I would say, so when I talk about, you know, when people ask me, well, gosh, how can I be a social enterprise? I'm saying some of it's just like any business, right? There's you're good and you're lucky and the time is right for your product. I mean, all those things kind of happen. And then you couple that with strong management. And then you can't have a recession when you're trying to grow. So we've had to make decisions on the enterprise side, just like other companies, which means we've had to lay off some staff. you know, say goodbye to some longtime customers that weren't that profitable for us. And so, you know, we've had to shift the type of parts that we make. So all of those are business decisions that we have to do to keep the business afloat. At the same time, because that the profit, so if the profits from your business aren't supporting your services, you have to take a hard look at your services and say, do we need to do all these services? Are there any that another nonprofit can do? We ask for, you know, for pay increases. We try to increase our philanthropy. So that money has to come from somewhere if your business isn't generating it. And so we've had to write for grants. We've had to get PPP loans. We've had to do all those things because we haven't had the same amount of money that's coming from our enterprise. So it really impacted us from the business perspective. And then I would say from our client perspective, our job training program, we just put that on hiatus for almost a year because that is a program that's designed for people that have been incarcerated that don't have a high school education. They're not comfortable using technology. And we found that students that were coming out of prison, they didn't want to do virtual job training. They didn't feel comfortable with their computer skills. And then at the same time, in Washington, we had a lot of limits on indoor gathering. And it's the middle of winter. It's Washington. You can't really have, you know, a basic computer class outside in the rain. I mean, those things kind of don't work. You know, we really tried to have our job training class virtual. I sat in on one, and one of the students was in his car. Another one was in his closet, trying to learn off of a cell phone this big. The cell phone kept moving, and then you'd have to stop. And, you know, and I just thought, this is not working for our students. So I would say from a job training perspective, we've had to, you know, really make big adjustments, and we're still trying to make it work because people need our services.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that and some of the vulnerability in it. You know, there's no question that I think even just from an individual perspective, but certainly businesses and then of course nonprofit organizations that we focus on have had to make significant adjustments. I think it's key. I mean, one of the big things that you brought out and one of the things that we've done just here at Charity Charge is just continue to narrow our focus and just make sure that we're just not doing too much. And we're constantly assessing what should we be doing less of instead of what should we be doing more of, which is counterintuitive. As the leader myself and just an entrepreneur by nature, I am a creative person and have all these ideas and all these other things that I want to be doing. But the only way for us to actually be successful is just to be very narrow in our approach. So I appreciate what you shared there. Talk to us just briefly. I do want to get back to some specifics about Pioneer Human Services itself. But you mentioned the relying on the balance sheet. I don't know if you're aware of the statistic, but 50% of nonprofit organizations have less than 1 month's cash flow in the bank, which mm-hmm. when there's a disruption that in the economy or the event that they thought they were going to have, where they raise their annual funds for the year gets canceled, it's disaster. How do you think about your balance sheet? I mean, and how do you think about budgeting for it? Is there an ideal like number or months of run room that you all like to have? What does having a good balance sheet mean to you?
You know, we ask our auditors that every year. What should we have? What should we have for days of cash? And I would say, you know, it really depends on your organization, your funding, you know, what you do. How easy is it for you to turn on or turn off a service? Mm-hmm. All those things kind of come into play. I would say that there's no golden rule. I know some companies have, you know, 8 months. We certainly didn't have that much, but, you know, we had more than 30 days. So I think that, you know, probably, and then if you save too much, you're not going to be able to discharge your mission, right? You're going to be favoring putting money aside for a rainy day rather than coming up with a new and innovative way to serve a client. So it takes a big balance of that. I would say that we did eat into ours about, maybe 20%. Mm-hmm. And I would say, but we also had a limit on how low we could go because we have agreements with our bank. So, because we have loans with our bank and our bank says, okay, you can't go below this amount. Sure. And so we've had to stay just above that amount. And then if we tip under that, we have to notify the bank. And then we have a lot of work that we have to do. So we've been lucky that we've only really tipped under that threshold that the bank set twice. But that is something that we have to keep in mind. So depending on how sophisticated or how many loans your nonprofit has, like we have, 600 housing units. So some of those are financed. That system of loans means that we have to work carefully with our bank to make sure that we're able to make our payments on time.
Got it. And which bank do you work with?
U.S. Bank.
Awesome. Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. I asked too, just because generally speaking, there's just so many different nonprofits out there and, there's banks that you can work with on a national level and then obviously local and regional levels and all can play a role. But I'm glad that you've been able to get them on board and work with them.
You have to, because like I mentioned, like we have, I think the number is 640 housing, apartment units. We just built one that's got 90 units. It's called Aspen Terrace, and that was a $31 million project. So, it was very sophisticated financing, and it was through low-income tax credits. And so, when you have those types of assets, then you have to have a close relationship with your bank or banks. You may have more than one, right?
Totally. Right on.
So, yeah.
That's great. I want to get back to a quote that I have in front of me of yours. I want to read it for the audience and for you to take in, of course, it's your quote, and then I'll ask you a question about it. So the quote is, we need to get to the root of why people don't behave the way society expects, because everyone can be successful if given the right opportunity and support. There's hope in creating safer communities that impact families and generate positive outcomes. I know, obviously, in starting this interview, we touched on some of the aspects of Pioneer Human Services, but the beginning of this quote is we need to get to the root of why people don't behave the way society expects. What does society expect, and why does society expect things a certain way?
I think society expects safety. We're here at the Seattle Mariners are our baseball team. The Seahawks are our football team. If I go to and where the stadiums are, that is it's an area with a lot of homelessness and low level crime. So if we drive and park at Lumen Field, I don't want my car broken into. First, I'm too cheap to park in the paid parking lot, so I park a long way away on on-street parking. And there's tents right next to, where I would park. And so what is driving that person to break into your car? Yes.
Well, sure. I mean, I think it's sort of what you were saying before, but they see the $20 bill. They need they want to go buy some beer, or maybe they need food on the table, or
exactly
a motel room or something.
They often, more often than not, they're suffering from an addiction or a mental illness. So let's take that a step further. Why do they have that addiction or mental illness?
I think if it's actually a true illness, they could have just been born with some sort of genetic disposition to it. But I would imagine it's loss of community, it's loss of a job.
Mm-hmm. Close. Yeah, trauma.
Yeah.
Trauma or an adverse childhood experience that's trauma related. Maybe the person's wife died, sister died, mother died. Maybe they were in a car accident. Maybe they were just victimized by poverty or sexual abuse or just a lifetime of being exposed to racism, right? So all those things kind, you know, and they could have been born with a proclivity towards a mental illness, or maybe they were born, you know, schizophrenic. But all those things culminate with an addiction, and drugs are very powerful today. So they're more powerful than they were 15 years ago. So, so all that is driving that person. And then the drug is doing all the thinking. There's no social norms there. What's talking is, if it's a meth addiction, it's meth that's doing the talking. So, so when I say let's, if we can get at the root. So in this case that we're talking about here, it's an adverse childhood experience or adult experience coupled with a coping mechanism that's related to drug use. Well, then let's get that person to treatment and keep trying and keep trying until the treatment sticks. If it's rooted in, let's just take a common experience for a Black person, you know, maybe, you know, they had a parent that was incarcerated. Maybe they lived in an area that was redlined and they only had one parent in the home. And then they were influenced by some drug dealers that walked by with flashy stuff. Right. Well, the root in that case was opportunity. So let's get at those. So as you could see, you know, but in some ways, it's easy to look at what that person did that day, but just take it back 10 years and realize that, you know, there was a person that their mother was maybe, you know, died from cancer and they never recovered except through drugs, or that, that they were really poor and they were, you know, really poor and really Black, and all that they could see for a way out of their community was, you know, selling drugs. And then that became life of its own, became gang involvement, and, you know, the rest of that story. So, you know, if we can, you know, I isolate those two examples, but you can just multiply that, right? You know, women and who they date. I mean, but, you know, all of those, at the end of the day, they're a human being with a story.
100%. I really appreciate you sharing that and what you're doing. I mean, I really resonated with it because, I mean, for different reasons than perhaps you do, but we have a large homeless population in Austin, which is where I'm based. And there's been a lot of debate and also put on the ballot, you know, different ways more recently that we should be addressing this. And the consensus, I mean, we've been very split as a community here, but a lot of people in Austin just want to move the problem and just try to like push it away. In other words, we had on the ballot to ban camping, and there have been no real solutions put out there to help solve this. It's just one of the areas. So it's just so important that we don't think of people that are homeless or people that are coming out of jail as we respect them as individuals and not as just lost members of society. And that's what a lot of times I think it is. And I appreciate what you're doing. And I hope that this episode spreads positive light, just giving people, you know, this is their first time sort of being introduced to what Pioneer Human Services has been doing for a long time now. Hope gives people a lot of hope. One of the things in closing out here that we didn't touch on specifically, you know, in just doing some research, it looks as if you all serve over 10,000 people a year through the diversion, treatment, housing, and job training programs. I'm curious if there's any anecdotes or an individual story or anything you'd like to highlight, you know, specific to just share with the audience that you could relate to on a more personal level.
Certainly. You know, one of the things that I like to tout is our job training program has a 4% recidivism rate. And I always preface that with
break down. I know we touched on it, but explain mm-hmm. recidivism to the audience.
Yes. And I will tell the audience that I am not a fan of measuring recidivism, but since everybody else does, we do too. But it is, it means that within 3 years of exiting a state prison, that you are not readmitted back into prison. So that's kind of a rough definition. And then localities will measure recidivism by the person reentering their system. And, you know, incarceration, you know, you have prison, you have jail, they're very different things. You have house arrest. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, it's not a very tight and clean. It's a very inconsistent definition. And then organizations can measure it differently. So at Pioneer, we measure it as in as any arrest, any arrest. So it doesn't mean going back to jail or prison or something. It's just an arrest. So we can, so it's 4%, less than 4%. So the most recent story was, I told you that we had an apartment building that we just built. And it's beautiful. And it and I was there about 3 weeks ago, and one of our case manager staff said, "Hey, Karen, I want to introduce you to a tenant." And then the tenant also was working for Pioneer, and the staff introduced me to him, and I said, "Well, I said, how are you doing?" And he said, "I'm 75 days free," and I said, and I was trying to catch up with where he was going, and then he said, because I hadn't really heard about it talk like that before. And he said, "Yep, I was in prison for 47 years. And he was released through what we call clemency. So that meant a lawyer went and helped him gain clemency. And because he had a life sentence, then he had wasn't eligible for any education or anything. That's how the prisons are in Washington. So he was a shock. He must have got a call one day in prison and they said, "Hey, your clemency was approved and you're going to be released in 3 days." And think about it. I mean, he had been in prison since the 70s. You know, he's in his 60s. His parents are dead. His sister passed away. You know, anybody he dated would have been, you know, I mean, he's 67. And so we have an arrangement with the Seattle Clemency Project that they'll reach out to us. And our staff, I don't know how they did it, but they were able to connect with him. He said he had to interview 3 times to get into our building. And then he was hired. And I said, "Well, how do you like life in community on the outside?" And he said, "Cars are smaller." That was the first thing he said. And he said, and he just said, "It feels good, but it's different." He said, "There's a lot of stuff at stores and a lot more selection than he's used to." And he said he was getting used to freedom every day, but he was really happy, you know, his job was part-time and he thought that was about as much as he should do because he's trying to catch up and learn all these things in society that he hasn't been able to for the past 47 years. And, but he had such an amazing attitude and amazing spirit. It was just a pleasure for me to meet him. I took a picture. I asked him if I could post it on LinkedIn and he said, yes. So if you go to my LinkedIn page, you'll see me and his name was Eugene Smith, called Smitty. You'll see a picture of him. And that story kind of blends with many stories over the years, but it's the most recent one that I can share. And you know, what good, you know, when a person has decided to change their life and they're incarcerated, what good does it do us to keep them locked up at that point? Seriously.
I appreciate what you're doing. And I just pulled up the photo. I see him right here. That's yep. Great.
Yep. So I would encourage anyone listening today to please log on to Pioneer's website, take our mass incarceration quiz, pioneerhumanservices.org/mass-incarceration-quiz. Follow our social media. Just educate yourself and become a friend and stakeholder Pioneer and join our mission. We'd love to have you.
That's awesome. I'm so glad to have you on the podcast, Karen. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For everyone listening, we're going to sign off here. This was an episode with Karen Lee, Chief Executive Officer of Pioneer Human Services. Check them out. Take care.